Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jeff Farber, Chief Executive Officer of the Kreft Foundation and a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors. It's my pleasure to serve as your chair for tonight's program. Tonight's program is generously underwritten by the Tobey Family American Values Series. This evening, it is my distinct honor to introduce Sally Pipes, President and CEO of the Pacific Research Institute, a San Francisco think tank founded in 1979. Sally is one of the nation's foremost authorities on healthcare reform, and as a native Canadian, she may be uniquely positioned to debunk the myth that a single-payer system is the answer for America. Her book, The Top 10 Myths of American Healthcare, A Citizen's Guide, examines 10 popular myths about the state of healthcare in America and challenges the conventional belief that only government can fix our system. Instead, Sally says that if we want to bring costs down and extend coverage to more Americans, we have to open the healthcare marketplace to competition. She advocates abolishing costly government regulations and reforming the tax code to make insurance more affordable. Sally's media resume is extensive, having appeared on ABC's 2020, CNN's Lou Dobbs Show, NBC Nightly News, The Today Show, and Dateline. Her opinion pieces have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Financial Times of London, and the New York Times, to name a few of the many publications that seek her perspective on this most pressing issue. She has been awarded many honors, including the Roe Award at the 2004 annual meeting of State Policy Network. In 2005, she was named one of the top 10 women in the conservative movement in America, as published by Human Events. In 2008, she was honored by the California Women's Leadership Association. She was also featured in a new book, Women Who Paved the Way, as one of 35 most outstanding women in business in our nation. Oh, and in 2006, Sally became a naturalized U.S. citizen. Please join me in extending a very warm welcome to my good friend, Sally Pipes.
Well, thank you, Jeff, for that kind introduction, and I'm delighted to be here on sharing the podium with Tad Tobey and Jeff Farber. So, and thank you all for coming. What I thought I would do is talk about the two visions for reforming healthcare in America, and then talk about the Canadian healthcare system, and then I will go into President Obama and the various bills that are out there right now, and why I think they relate to the Canadian healthcare system. And then I will end up with talking about my solutions, because one cannot be negative without having a positive response. So that's what I'm going to do. What I'd like to say is understanding healthcare is similar to unraveling an onion. There are many layers and many tearful moments. And this is certainly true. My husband said to me yesterday, the healthcare debate is causing a decline in your health. So it changes every 2 seconds, and it's very hard to keep track of everything. I think that everyone here would agree that the key goal for America is affordable, accessible, quality healthcare. The question is, how do we achieve that goal? There are two competing visions when it comes to healthcare reform. One focuses on patient-centered solutions, empowering doctors and patients, and encouraging innovation in drugs, biologics, and medical devices. That is my vision for reform. The other vision focuses on increasing the role of government in our health care through more mandates, higher taxes, and new subsidies. This is the vision that is on the rise today and what former Senator Ted Kennedy called Medicare for All. And this is also President Obama's vision. Very few people in Canada, where I'm from, realize this, and I think a lot of people in America don't realize it. 47% of the healthcare system in America today is in the hands of government, whether it's with Medicare, Medicaid, the State Children's Health Insurance Program, or the VA system. And there are a lot of politicians out there who want to take over that other 53%. President Obama has been on record saying that he does support a single-payer healthcare system. There are only two real single-payer healthcare systems in the world today. One is in Canada, the country where I'm from, and the other is in North Korea. Democratic Congressman Barney Frank, who is a major proponent of a single-payer system, said recently to a TV reporter, "I'm a supporter of single payer. We don't have the votes for it right now, but if we do get a public option, that is our path to a single payer healthcare system." So let's look at the reality of universal coverage as it exists under systems such as Canada's. First, affordability. Michael Moore, in his movie Sicko, where I have a cameo appearance, I was used as someone, it was an interview with Bill O'Reilly, actually, when O'Reilly asked me what I thought about the Canadian healthcare system, and I responded I didn't like it and pointed out the reasons. Michael Moore didn't include the reasons, he just included the cameo appearance. He used that to introduce the Canadians that he interviewed about the Canadian healthcare system. And I can tell you that those people probably haven't had to use the Canadian healthcare system for anything serious. But Michael Moore points out to the fact that the healthcare systems in France, Canada, the UK, and Cuba are all free. Well, they're not free because people pay through the nose through the tax system for these programs. How many of you here saw Michael Moore's movie Sicko? A larger number than a lot of audiences where I speak. I often say that's why it wasn't a success at the box office, because so few people saw it. Silvio Berlusconi, the Prime Minister of Italy, when he was told in Rome that he needed a heart pacemaker, did he go to Rome? Did he go to Paris? Did he go to London? Did he go to Havana, Cuba to have it installed? No. Where did Silvio Berlusconi come to have his heart pacemaker installed? The Cleveland Clinic here in America. The United States spends 16% of its gross domestic product on health care. Canada, on the other hand, spends 10%. In Canada, the government sets a global budget, the budget that they can afford, and that is what they spend on health care. It results in long waiting lists for care, ration care, and a lack of access to the latest diagnostic equipment. Let's look at quality. In Canada today, 750,000 Canadians are on a waiting list for a procedure. That's out of a total population of 32 million. So there are fewer people in Canada than there are here in the state of California. 17%, or 5 million out of the 32 million in Canada, are on a waiting list just to get a primary care doctor. So when you hear the president and different members of Congress saying, we need to encourage more people to go into primary care, people in Canada, docs don't stay in primary care because they're at the bottom of the totem pole. They're union members. Their salaries are negotiated by the medical association with the provincial government, and primary care docs are paid the least. So most young med students then do a specialty so that they can make more money. The average wait in Canada today from seeing a primary care doctor to getting treatment by a specialist is 17.3 weeks. That's over 4 months. Canada ranks 14th out of 25 OECD countries in MRI machines per capita and 19th out of 26 countries in CT scanners. 30,000 Canadians every year leave Canada and come to the United States and pay for procedures out of pocket because they don't want to be on a waiting list. I'll just tell you a quick story about my mom, who passed away in December 2005. In June 2005, my mother called and said, I think I have colon cancer. And I said, well, you better go to the doctor and get a colonoscopy. So she went to the doctor, and he said, well, you don't have colon cancer, that's fine. So she went home. And I said, well, did you get a colonoscopy? And she said, well, no, he checked my stomach and said everything was fine. And I said, well, you need a colonoscopy. And so she called back, and she was a senior. I was challenged on this, was my mother a senior? Well, if you look at me, my mother had to be a senior. So she was told that because of her age, she couldn't get a colonoscopy. Well, she had an X-ray, but that doesn't reveal colon cancer. In late November 2005, my mother had lost 30 pounds, and she was hemorrhaging. So I called the doctor, and she said, well, you'll have to get your mother to the hospital in an ambulance, because if you take her, you'll never get into the emergency room. And my mom spent 2 days in the emergency room, 2 days in the transit lounge, in transit, waiting to get a bed in a ward. I'd only seen the transit lounge at Heathrow Airport waiting to fly from London to Paris. Well, my mother did get her colonoscopy, and she passed away 2 weeks later from metastasized colon cancer. But this is what happens when government sets budgets, and the older people are the people who are hurt first. But politicians in Canada don't wait. Belinda Stronach, former Member of Parliament, first a Conservative and then became a Liberal, she opposed opening up the Canadian healthcare system to any private alternatives. And yet, when she was diagnosed with breast cancer, what did Belinda Stronach do? She came to UCLA, had her breast cancer surgery, and paid for it out of pocket. It was all right for her because she could afford it, but it's not all right for Canadians to have opportunity to get good medical care. As my friend in Vancouver, Dr. Brian Day, who is an orthopedic surgeon, former president of the Canadian Medical Association, told the New York Times, Canada is a country where a family can get a hip replacement for their dog in under a week, but a family member has to wait 2 to 3 years. Dr. Anne Doig, the new incoming president of the Canadian Medical Association, told the Canadian press a couple of weeks ago, the Canadian healthcare system is sick and it's imploding. Are there any encouraging signs in Canada? The Canadian Supreme Court ruled in June 2005, and the Canadian Supreme Court is not a conservative court, but the court ruled that the ban on private health care and private insurance for the province of Quebec was illegal because Canadians are entitled under our charter to life, liberty, and the security of the person. When you sit on a waiting list for a long time, you do not have security of the person. A number of other provinces are taking their cases to court right now. Madam Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin of the Canadian Supreme Court said, yes, Canada does have universal coverage, but the country does not have universal access. Access to a waiting list is not access to health care. Canadians intuitively know that long waits, ration care, and lack of access to the latest technology are the results of government-run health care, because in Canada, private health care is illegal. While no one can deny that there are problems in American health care, polls show that 82% of Americans like the health care that they have, and they intuitively understand that patient-centered solutions will lead to affordable, accessible, quality health care. 56% of Americans in the recent polls do not support President Obama's health care plan. And a recent poll shows that 45% of doctors said that they would very seriously consider giving up medicine if the Obama health care plan becomes law. Let's look now at accessibility. It's very clear that President Obama's number one domestic policy issue is health care reform. And he says over and over again, if you like your health care and you like your doctor, nothing is going to change. The president wants to have a bill to sign by December 31st, and Senator Harry Reid from Nevada has said that they will have a bill passed by the Congress by Thanksgiving. I don't know whether it'll happen or not, but that's what they're saying. President Obama's plan that he outlined on September 9th in his speech to Congress and the nation said that his health care reform package would cost $900 billion over 10 years and would be deficit neutral. That, by the way, was his 29th speech since becoming president on health care reform. But he said, $900 billion over 10 years, and it will be deficit neutral. How will they achieve a deficit neutral health care plan? Well, his first point was that they need to reduce fraud and abuse in Medicare and Medicaid by $450 billion. Now, I think it's interesting that the plan that the president is talking about, more and more government involvement in our health care, those are the very two plans in this country that are not cost efficient, and they're ripe with fraud and abuse. I don't know if anyone saw the 60 Minutes show last night, but it's about $60 billion a year worth of fraud in Medicare alone. They want to cut Medicare Advantage, which is the private Medicare program for people living in rural communities. They want to cut that by $130 billion over 10 years. And we have about 10 million seniors out of 40 million who are very happy with their Medicare Advantage program. They want higher taxes on the wealthy, higher taxes on insurers, higher taxes, excise taxes on drug companies, medical device companies, and, of course, Cadillac insurance plans. So where are we today with the bills? It's very hard to keep track. Senator Baucus's Finance Committee bill, which came out and was marked up last week, is 1,501 pages. It's called America's Healthy Future Act. And it's estimated by the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, to cost $829 billion over 10 years, with an $81 billion cut in the deficit. His Doc Fix bill, costing $249 billion, which would give doctors higher salaries for treating Medicare patients, because right now, docs are paid about 20% less for treating Medicare patients than they receive under the private system. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has now merged the finance bill with the HELP bill. That was the committee that the late Senator Ted Kennedy chaired. And at a press conference today, Senator Reid said that the new bill will be sent this week to the Congressional Budget Office for costing out. It does include a public option with an opt-out by the states by 2014 if the states do not want to participate in this public government-run insurance plan. He says he has 56 votes. He needs 60. We'll see. As I say, he lost the Doc Fix vote last week, which he wasn't expecting. Senator Reid has also said that Senator Olympia Snowe's trigger option will not be included in the bill that he's sending to the CBO. A trigger option is one that Senator Olympia Snowe, who supported the Finance Committee plan, would be that if costs do not come down and the number of uninsured do not go down, then we would see there would be a trigger to bring in this government-run insurance company to compete with private insurers. The three House bills have to be merged, Ways and Means, Energy and Commerce, and Education and Labor. The CBO has estimated the House bill at about $871 billion over 10 years. The Dems and Nancy Pelosi just said today they think they need to redo all of the House bills because they're talking about $1 to $1.6 trillion. I've never seen a government program that ever costs what a politician thinks it will cost. Medicare came into being in 1965 when Lyndon Johnson was the president. And in the first year, Medicare cost $3 billion. The precursor to the Congressional Budget Office predicted that by 1990, Medicare would cost $12 billion. Does anyone know what Medicare cost in 1990 cost the American taxpayers? $110 billion, 10 times what the estimate. And in Robert Reich's new book, he has a quote from Lyndon Johnson saying, if we had had an accurate forecast of what Medicare was going to cost, the whole thing would have been sunk. So looking at President Obama and the Democratic plans, how do we achieve universal coverage for all Americans while reducing health care costs? How can we do this? Well, I'd like to look at the main pillars of the plans that are out there. So pillar number one is the employer mandate. Employers under most of these plans would have to play or pay, i.e. if you don't provide health insurance for your employees, you would pay a tax of 8% of payroll to the federal government or a $750 fee per employee to offset the cost of the subsidies that the government would pay to your employees. And it doesn't matter if you had two people in your staff of 50 employees or more on getting a government subsidy, you would have to pay that $750 fine for your total labor force. The It's obvious in looking at the estimates from the CBO that the employers would choose to not cover their employees and move people into the public option. The Lewin Group has estimated that 119 million Americans would lose their employer-provided health insurance and be moved into the government insurance plan. So that's a large number because 64% of Americans receive their health care through their employer today. Pillar number two is controls on insurance companies. In recent speeches, the president has been talking about focusing on insurance reforms as opposed to health care reform. And he has outlined eight consumer protections, including no denying insurance based on pre-existing conditions, no lifetime caps, no price differential based on your health status. There would be a 40% tax on insurance companies offering Cadillac plans. Now, if you had been watching the media in the last few weeks, the unions were very upset about this because a lot of union members, of course, have these so-called Cadillac healthcare plans. The plan, Cadillac plan is designed as one that is $8,000 for an individual, and today it was bumped up from $21,000 to $23,000 for a family. This cost will not be borne by insurance companies. It will be borne by consumers. Because companies don't pay taxes, individuals pay taxes. Insurance companies, in effect, are going to become, under these plans, regulated utilities. Pillar number three is the individual mandate. By mandating that insurance companies include guaranteed issue, which means that an insurance company cannot discriminate based on your medical history, and community rating, meaning that you cannot discriminate based on price, based on your age, your sex, or your health status. So what will happen is guaranteed issue and community rating are in existence in New York and New Jersey. They have the most expensive insurance in this country today. They increase the cost of insurance. They do not decrease it. And what will happen is that people will buy insurance when they're ill, and when they get well, they will drop their insurance. This has happened in Massachusetts under Romney Care as we speak. In order then to expand the insurance pool, an individual mandate has to be part of any reform package. Specifically, young people will have to buy into the pool in order to spread the risk. But it is this very group that consciously decides that they will not buy health insurance because it's too expensive, they are healthy, they have no assets. They're who I call the young invincibles. But under Obamacare, these people are going to have to pay higher premium costs, and they're going to have to show that they have health insurance. In order to enforce the mandate, if you think back to when Hillary Clinton was running against Obama, George Stephanopoulos on ABC's This Week asked Hillary, well, because she wanted an individual mandate, he only wanted the mandate for children to have insurance. And so George said, well, Hillary, how will you enforce the mandate? And she said, well, George, I really don't know, but one way we can do it is to garnish people's wages. Well, under the plans that are being talked about right now, there would be fines for not having, for individuals not having health insurance. They were much higher a few weeks ago, but right now the first fine would be $200 beginning in 2014, going up to $750 in 2017. If the cost of a health insurance premium is more than 8% of your gross adjusted income, you will be exempt from buying insurance, just like in Massachusetts. 76,000 people in Massachusetts were exempted from buying insurance because it was still too expensive. You cannot cover 46.3 million uninsured Americans, or 29 million of them, as they have said would happen under the Finance Committee bill, and not have insurance costs go up, particularly when government mandates what makes an insurance plan. Pillar number four is the public option, and that's where all the debate is today. It is a government-run insurance plan based on Medicare rules and Medicare fees. The congressmen and federal government employees, of course, if you've been following this like I have, would not have to be part of the public option. They will be able to keep the insurance that they have under the Federal Employees Health Benefit Plan, which offers a variety of plans. There is no government plan, and it's not compulsory. The President and several members of Congress strongly support this public option, and it's being debated in a number of ways. One proposal is that doctors that provide health care under the public option would be paid at Medicare rates. And as I mentioned earlier, that's 20% below private sector rates that they get today. Then there is the Medicare plus 5%, which is being debated a lot right now. And then the third is to have the public option with the rates being negotiated between providers and the public option people who manage the public option. The plan that just came out today from Harry Reid, of course, is a public option which would allow states to opt out. And then, of course, the final thing, as I mentioned earlier, Olympia Snow wants a trigger. So if you didn't have a public option, if that went down, you would have a trigger so that if insurance costs don't come down, the number of insured don't come down, does not come down, then there would be a trigger to implement a public option based on Medicare rules. As Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has said, the final bill will have a public option. Pillar 5 is an insurance exchange. They want to create a new national insurance exchange, which would include both private insurers and the public government-run insurance plan. And the insurance exchange would be for small business owners and individuals, and they would get their coverage this way because if they don't get it through their job. On participating plans in the exchange, government would impose the benefit package, including, as I mentioned earlier, guaranteed issue and community rating. The cost of insurance will go up. It will not go down. When people talk about $1 trillion, $900 billion, $827 billion, you know, a number of economists have projected that any one of these healthcare plans with a public option will cost between $1 and $1.6 trillion over 10 years. I believe it'll probably cost, as I mentioned with Medicare, somewhere between $2 and $3 trillion. So if we have a government plan or a public option, as I've outlined, the demand for healthcare will be much higher than government people have projected. The cost of healthcare will increase more than the government wants to pay. And ultimately, the government will have to do like it did in Canada and set a global budget at a certain percent of GDP. As I said, we spend 16% today. I don't know whether 16% is too much. Perhaps it's too little. Americans demand the very finest in healthcare. They don't want to be told they have to wait. But if the government says we have to set a global budget, I expect it will be set at around 10%. Private insurers will ultimately be crowded out of the market, care will be rationed, and America will be on the road to a single-payer, Medicare-for-all-style healthcare system. Taxes and subsidies, in addition to the taxes that excise taxes on insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, medical device companies, there's set billion-dollar amounts that these companies would have to pay starting in 2010. The subsidy, that number that's out there right now, $461 billion over 10 years for lower-income people who cannot afford the premiums. There will be a tremendous increase in the number of Americans who are covered under Medicaid, and we know already that a lot of doctors will not take Medicaid patients because the reimbursement rates are so low. I mentioned, you know, getting rid of fraud and abuse in Medicare and Medicaid. They're talking they need to reduce that by $450 billion over 10 years. That's a lot of fraud and abuse in two government programs. If a health care plan is passed by Thanksgiving or towards the end of the year and signed by the president before the end of the year because he says he has to get health care done before 2010 starts because then you'll be in the next election mode and this will not be able to be done. So he's very committed to getting his health care plan done before the end of the year. He made it very clear during the campaign that it's very, very important to him. Polling data and outrage by Americans, it was very clear during the summer with the Tea Parties and the town halls that the American public did not support government takeover of their health care. So how do we achieve universal coverage using patient-centered reforms? First, I would like to empower doctors and patients. If we can put doctors and patients back in charge of their health care and get rid of the third-party payer system, all of us get our health care through a third-party payer, whether that third party is the government or whether it's your private insurer. We have a system in this country of first-dollar coverage, meaning that if you get your insurance through your employer, you pay a copay of $0, $10, $20, $30. Maybe you pay part of the premium, maybe you don't. 27% of employer-based coverage from families, they pay a copay. But anyway, because people think health insurance is whatever you pay in the copay or the premium or you pay nothing, that's what you think healthcare costs. And as a result, like in any other part of life, we have a tremendous increase in the usage of healthcare because people think it's free. We need to change the federal tax code because people who get their healthcare through their employer, they get that with pre-tax dollars. You don't pay tax on the value of your insurance plan that you get from your employer. But because our insurance is not portable in this country, if you lose your job and you lose your health insurance, then you go out into the individual market and you have to buy your health insurance with after-tax dollars. So I would like to see the tax code changed so we can level the playing field so that individuals can buy health insurance with pre-tax dollars as well. I think we'd see a tremendous increase in competition in the insurance market. And even George Shultz, I moderated a panel here a few months ago, and that was one of his key solutions as well. You know, government got us into this mess during World War II when wage and price controls were in. It was a way to give employers a tax benefit themselves and for them to attract employees without having to increase their wages. But of course, employees make less money because their employer is paying for their insurance. But as I mentioned earlier, 64% of Americans today get their health care through their employer. My next solution is the federal government needs to really help those people who do need help. One of the things they should do is increase federal funds to the states to beef up the high-risk pools so that those people who are uninsured, who have chronic conditions, those people would then be able to get their health care through a state-run pool. Those are the people, the 9 million people who are chronically ill without health insurance for 2 years or more. These are the people that I believe we should be taking care of. We need medical malpractice reform. PricewaterhouseCoopers came out with their estimate that the cost of medical malpractice, defense of medicine in this country per year is $210 billion. The president has said he supports tort reform, legal reform. I'm not really sure how serious he is about it. Certainly he said that Kathleen Sebelius would be in charge of doing some test programs. Kathleen Sebelius was, before being governor of Kansas, was president of the Trial Lawyers Association of Kansas. So I'm a little bit worried whether she might have a vested interest in keeping things as they are. But we do know that in Texas in 2003, they reformed their medical malpractice laws. 16,000 new doctors have gone into Texas. Doctors' premiums have declined significantly, and also the cost of health insurance has gone down. We need to cap non-economic damages at $250,000 and punitive damages at $500,000. Doctors practice defensive medicine because they are afraid of being sued. If we can take that away, we will have a tremendous reduction in our costs. As I said, $250 billion last year on defensive medicine. We need to make insurance portable. Insurance should be owned by individuals. Why should I, if I lose my job, why shouldn't my insurance be my insurance to take with me? And it should be able to be with me from when I finish high school or college right through my life. We don't get our life insurance, our long-term care insurance, our car insurance through our employer. This was a gift of the federal government, and it's caused a huge distortion in the market. We need to support consumer, patient-centered healthcare reform. The second to last thing is we need to allow people to buy insurance across state lines. If you're a young invincible living in New York and you have to pay $500 to $600 a month for your health care, you're probably healthy. You want insurance to be there for a catastrophe. You don't want to have to cover, you know, 48 mandates that are on that a state has put on an insurance plan that's mandatory. You want insurance there for a catastrophe in the event that you get cancer or in a serious car accident. So these guaranteed issue community rating add tremendously to the cost of insurance. But if you're a young 35-year-old like Deborah England here in the front row, I mean, why shouldn't she be able to find her insurance plan in Idaho or in Arizona or in whatever state offers an insurance plan that fits her personal or her family needs? We need to reduce mandates on insurance companies. Last year, there were 2,013 mandates on insurance companies. That's up from 1,906 in 2007. These mandates add between 20 to 50% to the cost of premium. Now, why should, if I want to have an insurance plan that includes in vitro fertilization like it does in many states, and it's one of the most expensive mandates, I should be able to buy that insurance plan. But why should Tad Toby have to buy an insurance plan with in vitro fertilization unless he's thinking of having a family soon himself? But why should he have to subsidize me? And so I think it's fine to have all of these mandates that people can buy a plan that suits their needs, but you shouldn't be forced to buy a plan with all of these mandates that add, as I say, between 20 to 50% to the cost of a plan. The question I ask is, who do you want to control your healthcare decisions? An HMO bureaucrat, a government bureaucrat, or do you yourself want to be in charge of your healthcare decisions? Universal choice is the key to universal coverage in this country. Moving to patient-centered solutions will give us affordable, accessible, quality health care. If we get any one of these plans that are out there right now, all of our taxes will go up. Even Tim Geithner and Larry Summers on the Sunday show said, we cannot guarantee that everyone's taxes won't go up. Remember during the campaign, the president said, we will only increase taxes on people earning $250,000 a year or more. Well, to cover the cost of these plans, even Geithner and Summers have said, we'll probably have to increase taxes on all Americans. Our taxes will go up, our quality will go down. Canadians come to the United States, as I mentioned, 30,000 every year to get tests and procedures done where they feel their health is important. They don't want to be on a waiting list. Where will the best doctors in America go, and where will we as patients go if the government takes over our healthcare system with a single-payer system? The Hippocratic Oath says, first, do no harm. I wish that politicians would think about that Hippocratic Oath, first, do no harm, before they do a takeover of our healthcare system. Thank you.
Our profound thanks to Sally Pipes, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Pacific Research Institute and author of The Top 10 Myths of American Healthcare, A Citizen's Guide, for her comments this evening. I'm Tad Toby, and a member of the Commonwealth Club of Board of Governors, and I will be moderating tonight's audience question period. Sally, we have a number of questions. I will just make a preliminary comment that many of the questions that were submitted were answered during the course of your comments, so we're not going to cover those again. We also had quite a few redundant questions, so we'll shrink the pool in that respect. And as the moderator, I'm going to exercise my prerogative to ask the first question. Specifically, given that this healthcare plan, or as was mentioned in the prior election campaign experiment, is going to consume possibly as much as 16 or 17% of the national wealth, and given that we're hard-pressed to come up with any government program ever that has worked, What is driving people's interest in yet another government program when, in fact, the Social Security program is, for all intents and purposes, bust? Medicare is scheduled to be broke in about 15 years. The post office can't operate without inducing a lot of competition to come into the market. There just basically are no government programs that have ever proven to be successful, or at the very least to operate on the basis of some kind of financial integrity. What's driving this thing?
Well, Tad, as you mentioned, I mean, Medicare and Medicaid, I mentioned the fraud and abuse number, but they are projected by the Congressional Budget Office, Medicare and Medicaid, to be bankrupt by 2017, and they're at $400 billion each now, and they're projected to be, by that at that point, up to $700 billion each, so they will be bankrupt. And the president knows that he has to get those costs down. He wants to, you know, he's very much in favor of reducing by $130 billion Medicare Advantage, the program that is really the HMO program for seniors who live in areas where there is not a lot of access to docs. I believe that this whole issue revolves around, it's not just about healthcare reform, environmental reform, you know, wage controls, things like that. I believe that the president has a vision for America where he believes that government is better able to provide for us than we as individuals are able to provide for ourselves. And I think that is the sort of the whole thing behind his vision for America.
Okay. The next question. We're told by the administration that some 46.3 million Americans are uninsured. How can we rationalize a wealthy society such as ours to maintain such a high percentage of uninsured people?
The number, the 46.3 million, is the latest number that came out in September from the U.S. Census Bureau, so we have to believe it's pretty accurate. Some people say it's more, some people say it's less. But I think it's important to break down who are the 46.3 million Americans. And interestingly, that percentage, as a percent of our population, has been fairly stable for the last 20 years at about 15%. As the number has gone up, our population has gone up. So it's about 15% of our population is uninsured. But the key point is, as I mentioned, because 64% of us get our health care through our employer, when we lose our job, we lose our health insurance. A lot of these people who are between jobs for a period of 6 to 9 months, and they haven't got insurance because they haven't got a new job with insurance. But when you break it down, 14 million of the 46.3 million people are people who are eligible for existing government programs, Medicaid, the program for low-income Americans, and the state children's health insurance plan for children. I believe that a lot of these people are not signing up for Medicaid. Some of them, of course, you know, live in areas where they probably don't even know that it's available. But I think a lot of them make a conscious decision not to sign up for Medicaid and SCHIP because they'd rather turn up at an emergency room because they know they can be treated quickly and they know that they can get a doctor that way, because 20% of people on Medicaid are having a hard time finding a doctor because of the doctor's low reimbursement rates. And if you remember Arnold Schwarzenegger, when he was trying to reform California's healthcare system in January of 2007, he kept talking about the hidden tax, that people who, the uninsured, are adding this tremendous tax to the cost of insurance for those who have it. It turns out that the uninsured only add about 1% to the cost of premium. The real culprit, the real hidden tax, is Medicare and Medicaid, because that accounts for 10% of the cost of premium for those people who have insurance, because those reimbursement rates are so low. So we have 14 million who are Medicaid and SCHIP eligible. We have 17 million of those people are people who are earning over $50,000 a year and are making, in many cases, a conscious decision not to buy insurance. And two-thirds of those 17 million are people, young people, between 18 and 34. As I mentioned earlier, the young invincibles, people who say, I'm not going to get sick, I don't have any assets to protect, why should I spend $500 a month on insurance when I can spend $500 a month on more interesting things? So they make a conscious decision not to buy it. If they could buy a high-deductible plan with a catastrophic insurance coverage, these people would buy insurance because they could afford it. But these mandates add so much that they make a decision not to buy it. Then we have about 9 million are people who are illegal immigrants. They're counted in that number. We have about 8 to 9 million Americans who are chronically ill without health insurance for 2 years or more. Those are the people I believe we should be helping. That is why I support adding a lot of federal funds so that they can give money to the states, so that the high-risk pools can be beefed up, so that these people can get insurances on an individual basis until we get a properly functioning market in healthcare, when there will be plans that will be able to take care of this when we reform the market. So when you break it down, we're looking at 9 million. We're not looking at 46.3 million. And I believe we should not be throwing out the world's finest healthcare system, because people do come from all over the world to take advantage of our healthcare system.
Sally, this is a question that I think connects to the statement that you just made. And the question is, why do we not hear about healthcare rationing by insurance companies denying claims, or the fact that thousands die each year because of lack of insurance?
This is something that is in the media all the time. And in fact, you know, it's an issue of rescission in health insurance. And, you know, even the president, when he told that story on September 9th about the person that, you know, their insurance was taken away, it turned out that even his own people said, well, the story was not true. There are a lot of stories that come out that just, you know, they're not based on fact. But I believe that if we can make these changes, reduce state mandates, allow competition, move to portable insurance, change the tax code, a lot of these people that don't have insurance will have it. And as I mentioned about the people that are chronically ill, they would be able to get their insurance through these high-risk pools at the state level, which right now are not funded well enough to take care of a lot of people that should be cared for.
Okay. Here's a question that somewhat relates to what we've been talking about. Are you in favor of health care savings accounts?
Yes, health savings accounts. I'm a huge proponent of HSAs. The precursor was called medical savings accounts, and they have been very successful. We have about 8 million Americans who have health savings accounts. You put your money each month into a tax-free savings account, and then you buy a high-deductible catastrophic insurance plan. You use the money in your account when you want, and then if you have a serious illness, you use your catastrophic coverage. I am very worried that under any of the plans that are out there with the House and the Senate and the President's plan, because they are going to determine what makes up a viable health plan, that it's going to be very, very difficult for the HSAs to survive. And the same with the flexible savings accounts, where people can save up $5,000 a year and pay out of pocket for various dental vision things. They've talked about they're going to reduce that to $2,500, and that's also going to take away people's individual freedom.
Sally, in April of 2006, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts passed Romney Care mandating that everyone have insurance. How is the program working, and is it a model for the whole country?
Funnily enough, on Wall Street Journal Opinion, .com today, there is a pro and a con on the Massachusetts plan. In summary, Romney Care was passed into law in April of 2006, as Tad mentioned. Massachusetts had one of the lowest rates of uninsured in the nation. They had about 10%, about 600,000 out of a population close to 6 million, so much lower than in California. Today, 430,000 people are covered under various programs in Massachusetts. They still have 3-4% uninsured, even though they have an individual mandate and an employer mandate. But I think the more interesting thing is that about 165,000 of the 430 people who have insurance, 165,000 are people who are now enrolled in Commonwealth Care, the free or the subsidized plan. These people, 20% of them, are not able to find a doctor because doctors aren't taking them because of the low reimbursement rates from the Commonwealth Care insurance plans. 76,000 were exempted from buying insurance because insurance was still more than 8% of their income. And we only had 46,000 people signed up for Commonwealth Choice, which is the private health insurance. So we still have uninsured. 20% of people cannot find a doctor on the Commonwealth Care. And we still have 23% of people in Massachusetts turning up at emergency rooms for care, the same percentage, before the individual and the employer mandate. So in my mind, and also premiums in Massachusetts are the most expensive premiums in the country. And so the government is saying this year, fiscal 2010, the plan is going to cost $1.75 billion, almost double what they had projected. And So now they're saying that we have to find a way to cut costs. They increased the tobacco tax, $1 a pack of cigarettes, but they're also saying doctors are going to be paid based on a global payment treatment scheme rather than being paid for individual visits to the doctor. And I know that a lot of doctors are not going to be like, are not going to support being paid for a global treatment as compared to being treated. So it's very expensive. We still have uninsured there, and a lot of people are having a hard time getting doctors. So I don't see it as a model for our country.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest today is Sally Pipes, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Pacific Research Institute, who is discussing with us the facts and fictions of the American healthcare system. Sally, you mentioned in passing the dilemma of runaway malpractice litigation, which, if I remember correctly, you cited approximately $250 billion a year in incremental cost over that which we might otherwise pay. Why aren't we hearing more about reforming this very serious problem that has such a major impact on insurance and medical costs?
Well, I mean, certainly we've been talking about it at Pacific Research Institute, Joe Nixon, former senator in Texas. And as I say, the president in his 29th healthcare speech on September 9th said that he really needed to look at, you know, medical malpractice reform because of the tremendous cost of defense of medicine. We know that in the states of West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Nevada, they have the very highest rates of med mal in the country, and they have a very low number of neurosurgeons and OBGYNs because they are the two specialties that face the highest premiums for their medical malpractice insurance. So I'm very hopeful that something will come of this. When the president spoke in the summer, you know, he said doctors, you know, are doing too many tests and you know, we need to cut this down. Well, the reason their doctors are doing these tests is because they are afraid of being sued. And a friend of mine at Mass General, who's a high-risk obstetrician, was sued for $14 million along with her partner when a young gal came in with her boyfriend and she was pregnant and her water had broken, and they said they had to deliver the baby, and their boyfriend said, "I will not have that." They left, and she came back 2 weeks later, and she died because of septic poisoning. And her parents sued the Harvard, Massachusetts Mass General and Harvard for $14 million. They won the case after 2 years because everything was documented. My doctor friend won the case because everything had been documented. But the pain and suffering of worrying for 2 years about what does this mean for your practice as a high-risk OBGYN.
Sally, do the insurance companies suffer unduly in terms of unfair treatment by the media? And what role do you envision should be assumed by the healthcare companies in an expanded insurance scenario?
Well, I don't. Certainly, there's a lot of criticism of the insurance companies, and Nancy Pelosi has called them evil. A lot of people call them evil. I think, you know, the insurance, as I said, 82% of Americans like their healthcare and they like their insurance. So my worry is that, as I said during my talk, that insurance companies, if we get, you know, all of these controls on insurance companies, tax on Cadillac plans, we are going to see insurance companies become regulated utilities. And I ultimately believe with the public option, as Barney Frank said, you know, they want a single-payer system. This is the way to get it. I think private insurers will be crowded out, and we'll all be in the government-run public option. The average profit for an insurance company is about 2.2%. You know, it's not, you know, it's much lower than the bank, what the bank profit, a number of other industries. So they do not make, you know, a tremendous profit, and but they are being villainized right now, and I'm very worried that it's going to be, we're going to see the demise. Because when the government took over the healthcare system in Canada in 1974, insurance companies, MSA, MSP, CUNC, they all thought, well, we will be the insurer of the government. But private insurance companies were wiped out overnight because the government was the insurer, and there's no private insurance allowed.
Sally, if, according to some of your comments, Canadian health systems are unsatisfactory. Why, and this is a question coming from one of our guests here, why are their outcomes so much better than ours?
Right, that is something we hear a lot, and I'll just make a few comments on it. When you see in the polls that the Canadian healthcare system polls well, when you poll the general public, most people, you know, are healthy. They don't need to see specialists, and particularly, you know, for procedures that are, you know, as I mentioned, the MRI machines, the CT scans, the number of doctors we have. So, you know, if you poll the general population, people, you know, it polls fairly well. When you do another poll and you poll the people that need to use the healthcare system for seeing a specialist, it polls very badly. The other point is that the government took over the healthcare system in 1974. You know, Canadians have grown up under a single-payer, government-run Medicare for All system, and most people don't know any different because that program has been around for 35 years. So people, you know, Canadians do come to the United States and pay out of pocket, but a lot of people just don't know that there is an alternative. And my final point is, and it's one that my mom used to say to me all the time, is I hope you're not becoming one of those impatient Americans. Canadians are very patient. You know, when people are told, you know, that you have to wait or you can't get this test, my friend had to wait 6 months to get a colonoscopy, and she was 50. I got a colonoscopy at 50 because my doctor said, you have cancer in your family, and, you know, you need to be tested. So, you know, but if you're 50 and you're suffering in a lot of pain, to be told that you have to wait 6 months for a colonoscopy or 4 months for an MRI when you're having serious headaches, this is not, I think, what we want for our people. The other thing on life expectancy, when you look at the World Health Organization shows that the United States ranks 37th in terms of life expectancy compared to lower than France, Canada, Morocco, Costa Rica. All of these surveys survey whether a healthcare system treats its people equally as opposed to treating people well. When you take out the homicide deaths, the car accidents, and out of our statistics, the United States comes out at the top of the pile. On a per capita basis, we have much higher rates of homicide, much higher rates of car accidents than any other countries. So if you take those things out, and these statistics are there, we actually do the best. If I was diagnosed with breast cancer, would I want to go to Morocco or Costa Rica? I want to go to the best place I can find here in America. And so it's very important when you're reading statistics, as my former boss used to say, statistics are a lot like sausages. You like them a whole lot better if you don't know what went into them. But it's very important in polling. The questions are important. In statistics, you have to know what you're surveying. But the United States, in terms of cancer survival rates 5 years out, the United States is the number one performer in the world, and 13 of 16 most popular cancers.
Sally, there were quite a few questions and comments about preventive care and support for preventive programs. Is there any evidence in any of the studies that you've done that could quantify the kind of results that might be achieved with aggressive preventive programs of various kinds?
Well, one of the myths in my book is about preventive care, so if you want a copy, you can read it. But the Congressional Budget Office has done a lot of budgeting on preventive care and what it will do to the cost curve, and they have shown that the cost curve will not go down by practicing, you know, expensive preventive care. It will actually go up, because if you start making everybody have mammograms and PSA tests and colonoscopies, and you start bringing in everyone, whether or not they're of an age where they might get these illnesses or whether there's no family history, it adds tremendously to the cost of preventive care. So, and interestingly, under health savings accounts, which we talked about a minute ago, under HSAs, people are 36% more likely to get an annual physical with an HSA than they are with regular insurance. We have to put responsibility back into individual peoples and not having government determine when you should get this and when you should get that.
Sally, earlier you took the $46.3 million so-called uninsured Americans apart, and you identified a large number of illegal aliens that are included in those percentages. The question is, why are the illegal aliens included in the various health care proposals, and should they be excluded from coverage?
Immigration is always a very difficult subject, and as an immigrant myself, I know how difficult it was to get a green card and become an American. Milton Friedman used to say that we could reduce our illegal immigrant population if we didn't provide free healthcare, education, and welfare to illegals. And I believe that, you know, if it weren't free, you know, we could reduce our illegal immigrant population. I just don't believe that, you know, taxpayers who are working hard should have to support people who are here illegally. But that's my personal view and not necessarily the view of PRI.
Trying to check the time because we have so many good questions here. Isn't our current system one that effectively covers all Americans in case of emergency? Does that not really, in effect, belie the claim that there are millions of Americans that have no care because they have no insurance?
Yes. We have in this country a law called EMTALA, which was actually introduced by Pete Stark, not really a free marketeer, but it was a Pete Stark bill. He's an East Bay congressman. And EMTALA says, the law says that no one can be turned away from an emergency room, a community hospital, or a community clinic if they turn up. So in effect, when I tell people in Canada that 46.3 million Americans are not born one day, they die 79.5 years later, and they've never had health insurance or health care, because that's what they think happens in this country. But we do have that law, and everybody is entitled to care, and and actually in a piece I just wrote for the DC Examiner, which came out yesterday, $30 billion is spent per year by people who don't have health insurance but pay for their health care out of pocket. Because, and particularly a lot of young people, would rather pay for various procedures or exams than pay for insurance because it's a bad deal for them. So we have a federal law. Everyone has to get care at one of those places. Now, it may not be the Mayo Clinic, but it's still, we have access to good care for all Americans.
One individual asked the question that Canada and North Korea were identified by you, I believe, as the only single-payer systems existing today. The question is, are not England, Spain, France, and Germany single-payer systems as well?
No, they are two-tiered systems. In Great Britain, at the end of World War II, the National Health Service was created. The National Health Service is the government-run plan, like our Medicare in Canada, but they allowed, under the law, private health care to run parallel to the NHS. When the politicians in Canada were looking to take over the Canadian healthcare system, a number of them went to England to find out how the NHS was run and, you know, what were the good things, what were the bad things. And they were told that the biggest mistake they made in setting up the NHS was allowing private healthcare to run parallel to the government-run system. And so so Canada didn't allow that. So France, Germany, and the UK have parallel systems. One of the interesting things is the waiting lists in Great Britain. You can read the stories in the Times, the Telegraph, of people waiting. You know, 4,000 people in London, you know, were waiting. They couldn't get a bed to deliver babies. There's all kinds of horror stories about people using the NHS and the waiting lists. And yet, so employers in the UK have been very much involved in providing private insurance. So people will use their NHS doc if they have a cold, but if they have a cyst or a tumor, they use their private health care. It's interesting, Jonathan Cohn, who's a friend of mine, is the New Republic, is a very big proponent of single payer and also of the French system. But if you look at these two-tiered systems with HMO-styled health care, they're all out of control in terms of costs, and they're having to clamp down more and more because the costs are out of control. And interestingly, The finance minister of Switzerland said, you know, we really have to do more to get our costs under control, because all countries are facing increases in the cost of their health care. We, you know, in America, with the great experiment with the HMO, the Health Maintenance Organization, in the 80s, costs were going down with HMOs. But what happened with the American people? They said, when you have an HMO, you know, the incentives are wrong, and you couldn't call up, you know, a specialist. You couldn't call up the doctor you wanted to see. So costs were going down, but by the early 90s, the American public rejected the HMO idea, and now, of course, we have the preferred provider plan, which is probably the most popular. But people in America don't want to be told, and even Uwe Reinhardt, who is one of my nemesis at Princeton, and we've debated several times, testified before Congress, he said that he does not believe that the American people, this gets back to my impatience thing, I mean, they didn't like waiting under HMOs. They didn't like being told who they could see. They certainly wouldn't want to wait under a government-run program where government sets the budget for health care.
I'm fearful that we've come to the end of our program. We had a number of really outstanding questions that we would have liked to have submitted to Sally, but we're just not able to do so in the time that we have. Our thanks to Sally Pipes, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Pacific Research Institute and author of The Top 10 Myths of American Healthcare, A Citizen's Guide. We also thank our audiences here and on radio and television and on the Internet. Tonight's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Tobey Family American Values series. I'm Ted Tobey, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you're in the know, is adjourned.